Monster Man, episode 528, Rock, Athasian, and Sand Bride. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through Athas, the post-apocalyptic fantasy world that is home to the Dark Sun campaign setting for AD&D. And today we've got two-page monsters, but both of them are basically just Athasian versions of monsters or monster types that we've seen before, so I don't actually think they'll take too long. First up, we have the Rock, Athasian. That is a rock in the Arabian Nights sense of a giant bird. It is pretty similar to the rocks we've seen previously, at least conceptually, and to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't bothered to check if it's similar mechanically. What's different about it is that we get a lot of detail on the process for how to tame and ride one. Now, that's not a bad thing necessarily. Like, on one level, I get this. As we've seen so far, a lot of what Dark Sun is about is the relationship between people and nature. So it makes sense that we would get more detail about this process than we might otherwise get. Like, we have seen taming systems in previous books, including in the Monster Manual, where there are rules for subduing a dragon, but they're a lot more in-depth here. And partly as a consequence of that depth, well, here's the thing. In order to tame and ride a rock, you either need to raise one from an egg, which takes 5 months of incubation plus a year of hand feeding and constant attention, during which time the young rock eats the equivalent of about 4 Erdlus a day, for a total of 1,460 Erdlus, or catch it in a big net, which has a whole complex system all to itself and might not work, but it might, and then train it for 5 months, during which time it's going to scoff down another 15 tons, that's imperial tons, so for my metric listeners, that's about 13.6 metric tons of meat, and then build a special saddle and try to ride it by making an animal handling check, which if you fail, you could die. Easily, you could die. That's if you've captured an adult. The one that you've hand-raised from a chick won't turn on you. And then train it for combat, which takes another 2 months. So that's another 6 tons of meat, or about, well, I don't know, 4.5 metric tons? I don't know. Something like that. And then, I mean, you get the picture. Or to put it another way, don't. I feel like not very many campaigns will have a player character with the resources to do this who also wants to spend a bare minimum of 7 months of campaign time doing nothing at all except caring for a giant bird. Like, can you imagine playing all this stuff out? It seems hard to imagine a GM not just hand-waving it. And if you have a giant bird that eats 200 pounds of meat a day, that's about 90 kilograms or so for my metric listeners, and you want to go adventuring, I feel like that becomes what your campaign is about. Do you ever forget the PCs, horses, and things? I have a tendency to. I'm not as bad about forgetting like henchmen and things, although I do sometimes. It's not as bad because I have made the henchmen into like fun little characters, and the PCs like to talk to them, so their urge to talk to them reminds me that they're there. But I forget the horses all the time. But I would feel a lot sillier forgetting a gigantic bird. I guess the ideal situation is that by the time you're high enough level for any of this to make sense, you are, you know, an elite group of guerrilla fighters taking the war to the bad guys, and you have a community that supports you, apparently a community with a lot of Erdlus, and you get an NPC who is basically your pilot, and then you can just, like, use a rock as your dropship once the charm of trudging through the arid wasteland wears off, because, you know, you can't fit 8 people on its back. So that's pretty good, I guess. And maybe the thing about forgetting the mounts is just me. I don't know. It just seems like a lot of hassle to keep track of. You start to run into a camel problem where it has to go around eating Erdlus. I guess if you're traveling with it, it can hunt in the wild, but presuming that it spends the majority of its time in the wild hunting, I don't know. Again, it might be one of those things where this setting's tendency to shine a light on the ecology makes me think more about these issues than I otherwise might. I am not, in the main, someone who prefers a naturalistic style. Anyway, next up we have the Sand Bride. Now, this is your basic tempting mirage monster. We've seen this in a whole range of different types in lots of different settings. What this one does is it's a malign spirit that animates sand, and it uses various magic spells to lure people into what appears to be a lush oasis. It usually takes the form of a beautiful woman. Surprise, surprise. Although it does say that it's not always a woman, just mostly, which is a weird detail. So it hangs out in this imaginary oasis, and it lures people in, and it offers the people a drink, but oh no, that drink is actually just sand. It's all just sand. And so when their mouth is full of sand and they're like spluttering and distracted, they take penalties from this, and then the creature pounces on them and drains their life force. At low levels, the Sand Bride could be quite a challenging opponent, since it is just made of animated sand and therefore is resistant to a lot of, you know, normal weapons just pass through it. It doesn't really have bones to break or organs to pierce. It's just a formless mass temporarily taking a humanoid shape. Also, there's a more powerful version of the Sand Bride, which is called the Sand Mother, but also referred to as the Mother of the Bride, and actually, that's quite funny. I think that if you are playing Dungeons & Dragons and you find an oasis inhabited by a solitary pretty lady who's being welcoming to you, although actually it sort of says that Sand Brides aren't that good at deception, which I like, you know, that their magic is useful, but they're themselves not very good conversationalists. So if you start asking them questions, they'll be weird and evasive. As if you needed any reason to suspect that something was up beyond the fact that you rocked up to a lonely oasis and there was a pretty lady hanging out there and just like offering you a cool refreshing drink. If you meet this person and you are not keeping a knife behind your back while you flirt, you are either the most complete rube in the world or you are a highly devoted role player playing a total mark. And honestly, I respect that. I feel like this type of monster shows up a lot in D&D because it shows up a lot in fairy tales and things like that. I get why it's included, sort of for the sake of completeness. But of course, what it is intended to demonstrate in the fairy tale is often that the person who is being bamboozled is a numbskull, or at the very least, is sort of naive and well-meaning. Like, what is the percentage of pretty ladies hanging out in isolated locations, your ruins, oases, whatever, in a D&D game that are fiends of one sort or another? Like, the average has got to be pretty near 100%. Are your D&D games usually filled with young ladies who just hang out in lonely oases or haunted ruins, flirting with, or in this case, offering cool, refreshing water to adventurers? And if so, why? Like, I might fall for this bit if it were the case that I routinely ran into pretty girls handing out cooling drinks, but I'd also have much more significant concerns. It all sort of depends on the game. The other thing is that, like, Athas isn't like that, right? Athas is a place where everything's out to get you. So you'd assume that this is the lure on some kind of monstrous sand anglerfish. If I were playing in, like, a Pendragon or Glorantha game, it's a coin flip whether this is just, like, a nymph who lives in this spring, because nymphs live in springs and that's the kind of thing they do. Or she's up to something. Well, she might be up to something, but she'd be up to a different kind of thing. Like, she might need my help in those other games. But that doesn't seem like the case in Athas. If she was some kind of wretch, I almost feel like it would be more persuasive. Be like, oh, who lives at this oasis? A weird beggar in a leather bondage harness who has a problem that he needs your help with. Yeah, okay, that tracks. But, you know, classic monster archetype, I don't think it necessarily works very well in any version of D&D, and I think it probably kind of works worse in Athas just because of the thing where Athas is such an absolute dump that it's hard to imagine anybody falling for this, you know, either in or out of character, but whatever. There are some fun bits, like I like the thing about she's actually kind of weird and off-putting. I think that's fun. So, there's some good little bits in here. All right, that is about all the Athasian monsters that I have time to talk about today. In our next episode, we will be taking a look at some monsters from the Silver Age of comic books, and I hope that you will join me then, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.